Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. In his thrilling and sparkling new book, Medieval Empires and the Cultures of Competition, Literary Duels at Islamic and Christian Courts, Samuel England, Assistant Professor of Arabic at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, analyzes with remarkable nimbleness the interaction of literature, politics, and power in medieval imperial settings. Effortlessly traversing from Buyid Baghdad to Spain and Italy, England shows ways in which literary competition, especially in poetry, pollinated imperial visions and fissures of political sovereignty. Literature and literary duels performed in the space of the imperial court, England convincingly argues, were critical to the assemblage of medieval imperial sovereignty. This finely written book will interest and delight scholars of literature, religion, politics, and history. Students of Arabic will especially appreciate the copious exhibition of wonderful Arabic poetry littered throughout the text. Here now is my conversation with Professor Samuel England. Hello, Sam. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, Sam, thank you so much for your time and for coming on New Books in Islamic Studies. You've written such a phenomenal book that I think will be widely read by scholars of Islam, Arabic literature, European literature, and really you've tried to combine multiple fields and scholarly conversations in such a masterful way. So really enjoy this book and look forward to our conversation. Sam, we actually have a tradition on New Books in Islamic Studies that our first question is always biographical. Could you share with our listeners how you became a scholar interested in Arabic, in sort of Muslim societies, and how you got to write this book? Could you share with us your journey as a scholar, how you become a scholar interested in these topics?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. So I guess if I start with my first exposure to Arabic, it was precisely the experience of not learning Arabic. It was the fact that I had lived in the Middle East, I'd lived in Egypt in the 1980s, and I was there for a couple of years and had a sort of typical, I would say, pretty sheltered expatriate life there for the couple of years I was there. Went to an American school and didn't learn a lot of Arabic. I came back and, you know, little by little, I was growing up and I went to college and I was interested in languages. And I thought, well, it would be really good to get back to the Middle East, get back to Egypt and see what that was all about and sort of experience it as a slightly less, you know, innocent kid. And luckily, you know, I was at a university with a good Arabic program, a very good Arabic program, the University of Michigan. And it was extremely challenging to kind of get involved in this language now as a sort of academic topic of study. I remember doing very poorly in my first class. But little by little, I decided that it really was something for me. And I, you know, wanted to use the language in Egypt. So I had a sort of goal of travel that helped to sort of sustain me through some of the rigors of the language. And I ended up being a major in Arabic, getting my BA, traveling a good deal in the Middle East and working a bit on comparative literature, which then ended up being my field of study when I was in graduate school.
Terrific. So, Sam, perhaps we could begin with a broad question with which you could perhaps introduce to our listeners the key themes, sites, and the kind of intervention that you're making in this book. So if you could perhaps combine some kind of an introduction to, you know, the time period, the kinds of imperial networks that you're looking at in this book, the context and the sites, but also perhaps comment a bit on this underlying conceptual argument that I saw running throughout the book, which was the relationship between poetry, literature, and imperial sovereignty or imperial order. And you really make a fascinating point that in some ways what you're showing in this book is the interaction of literature and politics in really interesting and nuanced ways. So perhaps if you could just introduce the book and this underlying conceptual theme and argument that underlies it.
Sure. Sure. Well, I think you have a couple of claims that are quite easy to make, and a lot of scholars have made in previous decades. One is that medieval leaders and politically sort of prominent people in the Middle Ages were very concerned with their empires and with the military borders of their empire and maintaining sovereignty. So that's an easy claim to make. Another easy claim to make is that they were obsessed with their own cultural standing, how they appeared to other members of the court, how they appeared to other courts, how well their diplomatic machinery worked, what kind of literature was written in their names and how it made them look. That's another easy claim to make. And what I sought to do with this book was sort of bring those together, which I think we've done insufficiently in medieval studies. I think there were a couple of real sort of breakthroughs in studies of classical ancient literature. I remember reading a book by Leslie Kirk, The Traffic in Praise, which sort of demonstrated quite vividly how institutions that were paramilitary, like the Olympics, were intimately tied to praise poetry. We are making those claims little by little in medieval studies. But I think one of the really important claims that remains to be made is that this is an explicitly comparative kind of approach to the Middle Ages, and that it is entirely legitimate and interesting to ask these sort of imperial questions about not just Arabic literature in an Arab context, but also Arabic literature as it was being sort of dominated by people who are not native speakers of Arabic, people like the Buyids or the Buyids. Similarly, with Romance traditions in Spain, as I talk about in the latter chapter in the book, and of course the entire process of the Crusades, I argue in the book was largely a literary cultural campaign. So I saw these as kind of available points of new ground to break, and I think that's what motivated me through the years of writing.
Now, one other sort of broad conceptual intervention that you make throughout this book is your insistence on the argument that one cannot look at these pre-modern archives according to the assumptions and binaries of modern politics and, this binary between looking at these empires either as champions of multiculturalism or as essentially promoting some kind of religious difference, that these are inherently modern assumptions that we can't impose on these pre-modern archives. Could you talk a bit about this underlying conceptual argument that you make throughout the book? In what ways do you find this book interrupting the imposition or the mobilization of modern binaries and assumptions on the kind of pre-modern archive that that you're looking at?
Well, okay, part of the formation of medievalists in Arabic and Romance is to study Al-Andalus, and that's, in very much a worthwhile field in which to view arguments of multiculturalism. And as, I'm sure you're aware, but maybe it would be helpful for some listeners to kind of walk through moments in the mid part of the 20th century, and then later in the 1980s and 90s, where you had these multicultural scholars, very prominent multicultural scholars like Americo Castro and later Maria Rosa Menocal, who were deeply interested in what they considered to be restoring the multicultural identity of Andalusi culture. And I have a lot of respect for those efforts that they made. I think, though, that we've had a sort of, it's left us with a little bit of a limited vocabulary of discussing the court cultures as they existed then. I mean, they tended to constantly, no matter how multicultural they were, multi-ethnic they were, in the arts and in the literature that they produced, constantly try to argue that there was, a singular tradition that they were appealing to. Whether they were actually doing that is a different question. But the literature that they produced, and I don't know, you'd have to ask an art historian, but perhaps in some of the visual arts that they produced and in their manuscript traditions, they're constantly saying, well, look, there are kind of a singular, there's a singular set of criteria that we're appealing to, and that has to do with, you know, beautiful Arabic. It has to do with the soundness of our rhetoric. It has to do with the standing of a particular, you know, poet who I've just hired. And so, you know, they were not themselves, you know, great advertisers of any kind of multiculturalism. That is, you know, as you've pointed out, very much a sort of modern lexicon that we've used. And I think it was very helpful in the context of politics in the mid-20th century, in the late 20th century. But if we're going to take, you know, seriously the call of medieval studies, I think that it's very useful to evaluate the rhetoric and the poetic production of these courts as they existed at the time. And they tended to sort of present themselves as being textual monocultures. I'm not saying that's what they were. I'm saying that's how they talked about themselves.
Now let's move to some specific contexts that you explore in the different chapters of this book. Let's begin with the chapter on Buyid Baghdad and what happens with forms of poetry and literature with the emergence of Buyid power. Could you talk a bit about the kinds of shifts and continuities from earlier Abbasid forms of literature that you find with the emergence of Buyid power in Baghdad? And you make an especially very interesting point that this distinction between administrative and artistic forms of literature sometimes is framed as too much of a binary, that there is a cross-pollination between them that you try to capture. So could you give us some examples of the kinds of literary production that you find in Buyid Baghdad and how that relates to Buyid attempts at maintaining some degree of political order and sovereignty?
Sure, yeah. You have this big breakthrough in the secondary level of political authority in the Abbasid Empire of viziers, and viziers coming not only to speak for whatever kind of princes, the Buyid emirs who they work for, but essentially creating their own semi-autonomous courts, and their courts being eventually the most powerful and productive and dynamic courts in the empire. If you take Abul Fadl ibn al-Amir as what I would call the kind of, you know, great vizier to break through, I mean he was mostly known for his prowess in composing prose, and he could be extremely persuasive and magisterial in prose. He was known for being this kind of prose master. And you know, what I argue in the book is that he expanded the vocabulary by which not only viziers were judged, but by which writers themselves were judged in the 10th century or 10th century CE anyway. Now, after that breakthrough, I think that the idea of a vizier, of an extraordinarily powerful and sometimes conniving vizier, became its own kind of institution in the medieval empire, and then incidentally was reproduced in all sorts of Orientalist representations in the modern era. If you look at, you know, a Disney film like Aladdin, the figure of Jafar, you know, but based on an Abbasid vizier is that kind of fiction. Well, that fiction has its roots a long time ago in these medieval productions and in the sort of fascinating medieval personalities who were hassling each other through prose or were writing this kind of aggressive type of poetry in order to intimidate one another or to show how great their Arabic was and how they shouldn't really be thought of as Persians per se anymore or Iranians per se anymore, even though that's what they were, because they dominated an Arab court. The Arab court was essentially theirs at that point.
Now, the next chapter of the book is titled The Sovereign and the Foreign, Creating Saladin in Arabic Literature of the Counter-Crusade. I was wondering, Sam, if you could elaborate a bit on this category of counter-crusade that you mobilize in this chapter, and tell us a bit about ways in which, again, literary production in this context was really aimed at garnering the authority of the ruler, in this case, Saladin. And you really make this interesting argument about relationships relationship between literature and the assemblage of the sovereign's power, basically. So could you tell a bit about this category of the counter-crusade and then this underlying argument that that you present and advance in this chapter?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the political parallel I would draw between what goes on in the first chapter there, what I'm discussing, the very end of Abbasid sovereignty, and in the second chapter, where I'm talking about, as you say, the counter-crusade, is that you have a regime coming out of a momentary political vacuum in which the caliph has become very weak. So not only had the Abbasid caliphate sort of begun to wither and be subject to control in the late Abbasid Empire. In Egypt, you have this Fatimid caliphate that was really extremely feeble by the time that Salah ad-Din kind of rose through the ranks of Levantine and Egyptian military service or military officer corps. So when he emerges, I would say that the sort of political theme in Islamic institutions along the Mediterranean coast there from Egypt up through northern Syria was really ripe for an intervention like his, or an intervention like that of him and his other Kurdish military experts. And what they needed, of course, in addition to being very smart militarily and being good at assembling armies and eventually, dominating forts and towns and garrisons and cities that had been controlled by crusaders, what they needed in addition to that was a certain amount of cultural legitimacy in Arabic. They were very intensely interested in Arabic literature. And this is, I think, a really understudied element of what went on through centuries of counter-crusading. And so, what I wanted to do was investigate this poetry, but also prose, the kind of, what they call belles lettres, adab, meant to glorify this regime, to create a useful figure of a crusader who, of course, in this literature would eventually become dominated by Islamic forces, and to create a persona of Salah ad-Din where it essentially had not existed before. When he made his intervention politically, he was very much in need of the kind of personality that a great court patron would need to have. He needed to have anecdotes about him. He needed to have, praise poetry. He needed to have a sort of system of hijay, of satirical poetry, most of which was written about Franks and Crusaders, but not all of it. Some of it was with his kind of more internal enemies in Egypt. And that project, there's very little scholarship on it, at least in English. And so this was actually one of the most exciting and I should say fun parts of writing this book. It was really something that I hadn't known very much about before, and found that there was a lot of room to really say something new.
Terrific. As before I ask the next question, I would just mention this for the benefit of our listeners, is that one of the great features of this book is that you also present in copious detail and instances actual text from the Arabic sort of poetry and other forms of hijay and other kinds of literature that you're looking at. So it really is a very nice reader also in some ways for students of Arabic and those who are invested in these traditions. So I think that was a really great sort of aesthetic move that you made in terms of the production of this book.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's kind of you to say. I don't pretend that I have anything to teach you about classical Arabic, but it's sweet of you to say.
So let's now move to the theater of Spanish courts and the context of Alfonso X. And let's come back to the conversation with which we began this interview, which was ways in which you complicate this understanding of looking at pre-modern figures and empires as champions of multiculturalism. And you make the point that Alfonso X in a lot of modern scholarship is precisely looked at in those terms as a paragon or a champion of multiculturalism. But you rather show that in some ways he used poetic language as a way of developing a certain narrative of conquest. And what you argue in here, I quote from the book, as a way of demarcating and enforcing rules of difference. So could you tell us a bit about this argument and ways in which you complicate this picture of Alfonso X as some kind of a champion of medieval multiculturalism?
Well, I think the label of multicultural and the sort of facility with which it's been applied over the past, let's say, 5 decades, one of the problems with that is that it suggests that cultures sort of mingle and create this new sort of interesting synthesis, you know, something that's more than the sum of its parts culturally. And so I think with that statement of trying to enforce rules of difference, what I'm trying to say about Alfonso in particular was that his court was extremely multivalent. It was culturally multivalent and linguistically multivalent. He has this side of his poetry, you know, completely in the language of Galician Portuguese, the sort of dominant lyrical language of Iberia during this period, during the 13th century, in which, you know, he praises the Virgin Mary. He has this huge songbook, Cantigas de Santa Maria, which are extremely well covered in scholarship. And then he has this relatively small collection of satirical poems, songs, also in Galician Portuguese, which came to be called Cantigas de Escarnio y Maldicer, so the Cantigas of insult, of the Cantigas of denigrating other courtiers or denigrating Arabs, Muslims, etc. That's really not well covered in critical scholarship today. And what's interesting, if you take these cantigas kind of as a whole, if you view them panoptically, you see that not only is he very conscious of seeming powerful through these cantigas, he's also always very vulnerable, makes a lot of statements of sort of regrets and talks about what he wishes that he could have fulfilled, the promises to Mary that he could have fulfilled, including pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Jerusalem takes on enormous weight in this poetry, and he sort of can be very hard on himself or criticize himself, and also take this prospect in poetry in which he says, well, at some point our kingdom, our empire is going to plant a flag in Jerusalem, just as we always wanted, or at some point I will be buried in Jerusalem, as would be fitting. In the poems in which he's criticizing or making fun of people, a lot of the people he makes fun of are his own knights for being very bad at crusading, for being very bad at fighting Muslims. I think it's not only appropriate, but it's necessary to talk about the songbook, the sort of proper songbook of praise of Virgin Mary, together with this kind of insulting, seemingly sort of lowbrow or bawdy type poetry. I'm not the first scholar to do it, but what I think my book does that's new is talks about all of this as a form of crusader poetry.
Terrific. Let's now move to yet another site, another sort of archive that you look at, which is the writings of Iberian and Italian authors, which you look at in chapter 4 of this book. And you really show ways in which these authors adapted and repackaged Saladin in ways that brought out new dimensions of his persona as a leader. And you say this in the book, and I quote here from page 141, you say, utilizing him as a liminal border-crossing agent, late medieval romance texts opened a complex literary discussion on who best represented the court and whether the court would continue to sustain high culture. So could you speak a bit about ways in which this repackaging of Saladin and adaptation of Saladin happened, and some dimensions of that at the hands of these Iberian and Italian authors whom you examine in the next chapter?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the premise of this chapter, and the premise really of ending the book this way, is that the failure from a perspective of a Christian in Europe, the failure of the Crusades, was extremely productive for views upon the Holy Land, who inhabited the Holy Land, who had a legitimate claim to the Holy Land, and you know, who needed to be kicked out or killed there. So Salah ad-Din, you know, is this historical figure who becomes then a fabulous figure, becomes a character of fable. And in, you know, poetry, in narrative fables, in anecdotes, Salah ad-Din acquires all of this complexity in European literature, in literature that was composed in Romance languages, and for that matter, you know, languages that I don't discuss in the book, in the Germanic tradition, in, I believe, in Anglo-Saxon as well. But in the material that I discuss in this chapter, you know, namely these Romance languages of Southern Europe and especially Southwestern Europe, you know, he's very dramatic, and he compels the literary audience and the members of these courts as they kind of survey the ruins of the Crusades, to also kind of question the political bodies that had organized the Crusades. So things like the papacy and the relationship between royal courts and the Pope, the relationships between ethnic groups who had inhabited Europe, you know, the idea of Jews in Europe somehow having a connection to Salah ad-Din, or being able to speak to him in his language, you know, through this kind of very loose association of their ethnicity, or the fact that they would somehow have roots in the Holy Land, even though they lived in Italy. Of Salah ad-Din speaking many languages, of him being sort of a partial member of the court, you know, in Dante's conception, he's in limbo. He's a very courtly person. He speaks a courtly language. Dante attributes all that to him, and yet, you know, he's definitely not going to make it into heaven either. He sort of belongs in this category with some of the great Greek thinkers, you know, who were, of course, pagans, but happened to be very intelligent, and helped Dante kind of you know, imagine what a righteous, intelligent person was. So, you know, I guess what it is to me, you know, Salah ad-Din going from being a very sort of two-dimensional type figure in you know, the early Latin chronicles and in vernacular languages in Europe, eventually becoming this you know, hugely multifaceted and really interesting character in the production of fables and in poetry of the type that Dante wrote, and the secular narratives that Boccaccio wrote.
Sam, you conclude this book by coming to the modern period, specifically to the context of 20th century Iraq, and by looking at ways in which Saddam Hussein, whom you sort of call a self-professed modern Salah ad-Din, tried to draw on this heritage of Mesopotamia, and this heritage of literary and cultural production, to showcase Iraq as an ideal form of a secular polity in the 20th century. And you really focus on two events that were held, and you try to look at some of the complexities and problems associated with ways in which a modern political figure tried to appropriate these pre-modern courtly rituals and forms of poetry. So could you tell us a bit about what these two events were and how this unfolded, what exactly happened, and what kind of a point that you tried to make by ending your book on this note from the modern context?
So the two events, let me just make sure that I'm clear that the two events are one being the Mirpad festival. Is that right? And the second one to your reading, because I'd actually be quite curious how you read this conclusion.
The Babylon International Festival.
Ah, I see. Okay, yeah. So I tend to talk a lot more about Mirbad, and to be perfectly frank, I know a lot more about the Mirbad festival than I do about Babylon. I guess if we put them together, you know, you have these projects from the Ba'athist Iraqi Ministry of Culture. From the 1970s on through the 90s, through the beginning of the decade of the 90s, to sort of recreate this either ancient or medieval glory that they thought of Iraq as having. You take a figure like Salah ad-Din. Salah ad-Din, of course, was Kurdish, but you wouldn't hear a Ba'athist official, and certainly not Saddam Hussein, as much as they love to paint, you know, murals of him and erect statues and compare Saddam to Salah ad-Din. They would never attribute to him any of his Kurdishness, even though that, you know, it's absolutely inseparable from his identity, his life, and his career. What they always focus on is his roots near Tikrit, and of course those, you know, the reasons for that would be obvious. They brought in you know, these huge numbers of artists, of poets, most of whom were Arab poets, but not exclusively, and what they called Orientalists, you know, the 1970s and 1980s sort of elite of professors, of translators of literature, and they you know, would fly them in at least 1 year in 1988, flew them all in on the budget of the Iraqi state, on Iraqi airlines, into Baghdad, and then, you know, got them on buses and such to Basra for the Mirbad festival. And they produced all these sort of pamphlets, and, you know, if you look at the record of Mirbad related publications from Iraq, a huge sort of complex of the proceedings of these conferences, of research that was presented, and of these praise poems that were presented directly to Saddam Hussein. So I began that section, you know, the conclusion of the book. I began with this question of what was it that Saddam was looking at when he came in to the room? Because having spoken with one of my previous mentors about who had actually attended the Mirbad Festival, he said, you know, Saddam would come in for 15 minutes at a time, an hour at a time, and stare off into space. He would kind of stare between. I mean, you know, just thinking about that, I mean, you know, you have all these websites now. I don't know if you've ever seen any of these things, you know, like Kim Jong-il looking at things, or, you know, Gaddafi looking at things. And you realize, like, that there's a pop culture fascination with, you know, these self-curious dictators going around and looking at, you know, I don't know, ground being broken on the next bridge of, you know, of wonder and excellence in southern Libya, or, you know, looking at a statue that's just been, you know, cast from bronze with, you know, them in a loose fitting robe, or, you know, all of these kind of ridiculous self-important things that dictators do. So Saddam, anyway, would receive these poems by, you know, taking his seat of honor, and he'd be there with his entourage, and he would stare off just next to the face of whoever the poet was standing up there talking about how great he was, and he would kind of look off into the background, and I just use this as the sort of imaginary of what it was he was staring at, and you know, I end up claiming, I don't want to give too many spoilers here because, of course, you know, you want people to buy and read the book, but using that as my way to kind of argue through the end of the study, and to talk about some of the some of the stress and some of the self-questioning that might occur even to a fascist when considering his own court.
Sam, as we're coming to the end of our time, could you perhaps share with our listeners what's the next project that you're thinking of doing?
You know, I think it's largely motivated from this conclusion. I would really like to produce a lengthy study of the role of the Middle Ages and of classical Arab culture in the formation of military states. You know, it's something I'm beginning now. It could take all sorts of different directions, but it is certainly the topic that, having left off the project of writing this book and putting in those, you know, years of work and research and revision and sometimes tearing my hair out, this is a topic that still really animates me a lot. It's something that I'm still very curious about and think that I have a lot to learn about. One of the reasons I have a lot to learn about it is I don't think that we've explored it very much in contemporary criticism. So, you know, stay tuned, and I'm hopeful that in a couple of years I'll have something more to say on it, since the conclusion is relatively brief.
Medieval Empires and the Culture of Competition, Literary Duels and Islamic and Christian Courts by Samuel England, published by the University of Edinburgh Press in 2017. Thank you so much, Sam, for this wonderfully rich, nuanced and fantastic book, and for your time today in sharing some of your thoughts with our listeners. I really appreciate your time, and thank you again for this book.
Oh, you're most welcome. It's been a real pleasure, Shirali, and it's great to talk with you once again after all these years.
Thank you. So this was my conversation with Professor Samuel England about his wonderful new book, Medieval Empires and the Cultures of Competition. I hope you enjoyed this episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. And I also hope that you will join us next time for another fresh episode of your favorite podcast on the New Books Network, New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and please keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.